If you've ever walked past a Cinnabon kiosk in a mall food court, you know that there are powerful forces out there that beckon us to indulge in sugary treats. That's why for today's Please Explain, we decided to look into the neurological secrets behind our relationship with food and find out why we sometimes choose a warm, gooey cinnamon bun instead of a nutritious banana. Rachel Hertz, a neuroscientist specializing in perception and emotion, is the author of You Are What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food, published by W.W. Norton & Company. She examines the sensory and psychological factors that influence our eating habits, and I'm happy to welcome her to today's Please Explain. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Cindy. It's great to be on. And if I could just say, my book is called Why You Eat What You Eat.
Ah, sorry about that.
That's okay. It is what you said, but it's a specific title is Why You Eat What You Eat.
Got it. Okay. And I also want to invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you have a question, give us a call at 212-433-9692. So, Rachel, let's first talk about taste. What exactly is taste, and how does our sense of taste work?
So taste is really just the four basic sensations of salt, sour, and sweet, and bitter. And taste works as a function of the taste receptors that are primarily on our tongue, but they're also elsewhere in our mouth. They're in our cheeks, and some of them are in the roof of the mouth, as well as the throat. And when we have certain kinds of chemicals that interact with those taste receptors on the tongue, it sends a signal to the brain to perceive that sensation. But what we normally mean when we say the word taste is actually flavor. And flavor primarily comes from our nose. So that is to say, the taste of bacon is just salt. The flavor, the aromatic component, is what makes the difference between bacon and smoked salmon and steak and anything else that might be salty or a French fry. It's the smell that is producing that experience, and that's what is happening. But the brain knits the two things together, and because it's coming from the mouth, we feel like it's the mouth, and so we say taste.
I see. Okay. And so also, though, animals, for instance, don't have the same taste receptors as humans do. Is that right? So cats, for instance, can only taste certain things?
Exactly. So, for example, in the case of cats, what they are known as in the animal kingdom is strict carnivores. So all they need to really be concerned with, particularly, is salty taste as well as some other taste, but they don't need to care about sweet because sweets is the taste signal for carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are, for example, in fruits and plants and in cinnamon buns and everything else. But because they only eat meat, they're not exposed to sweet taste, and so cats can't taste sweet.
I see. Okay. And so also, you know, it was thought for a while that there was sort of this tongue map that, you know, certain receptors for sweetness were only in certain parts of your tongue, but that turns out not to be true. On the other hand, there is sort of a map of the neurons in the brain that tell us, for instance, to respond to sweet in a certain way. Do I have that correctly?
Yes, you do. So the tongue map, which unfortunately still routinely makes its way into textbooks, as well as if you were to go online, you'd find it very easily. That's sort of an example of an unfortunately nice illustration incorrectly explaining science based on some mix-up that happened, you know, over 50 years ago. And even though it was corrected, you know, 40 years ago, we still sort of have this in our zeitgeist. But the actual, so we can taste anything anywhere in our tongue equally. So not there's no specificity in terms of those particular areas. But in the taste cortex of the brain, it does turn out that it is mapped out in a taste-by-taste fashion. So that is to say that, for example, you could tickle the bitter part of a rat's brain and have it have something sweet in its mouth, and it will act like it has something bitter in its mouth, and vice versa. And the tantalizing implication is that if, for instance, we were eating like kale or other things that weren't quite as tasty to us but are very healthy, and we could somehow stimulate, you know, the sweet receptors that are active, that are controlled by the brain, then we might actually say, this is like candy. This is, you know, give me some more. And, you know, if we could somehow manage that, that would be a whole way to, you know, make people eat very healthily.
Right. And that's happening, right? The pharmaceutical companies are all over that?
Well, that is something which is in the works. I don't think it has happened yet. This is something that's sort of a pipe dream at the moment, but it is something that we can do in animals, but figuring out how to do that in humans hasn't happened yet.
I see. So let's go to a caller. So let's go to Joy in Manhattan with a question about carbs.
Hi.
Hi, Joy. You're on
Hi.
The air.
Yeah, so as far as carbs are concerned, so why do some people, like myself, crave them, but not necessarily fruit, but more like, not necessarily cinnabuns, but bagels or bread or pasta or, I'm just trying to think of, or some type of snack food.
Right.
What triggers that quote-unquote craving?
And Joy, do you have those cravings at a particular time of day by any chance? Because I know I do.
Maybe as the day wears on, so not necessarily in the morning, although I do have like a piece of toast or something or a small roll with breakfast, but as the day wears on and actually towards the end of the day, yeah.
Okay, so Rachel, can you help answer that?
Sure. So there's a couple of pieces to that. And one is that carbohydrates, like you're mentioning, breads, pastas, and things like that, are a major component in comfort foods.
Mm-hmm.
And comfort foods make us feel good for two reasons. One, the carbohydrates are actually activating your bliss points in your brain. So your brain is extremely happy when you have carbs. Unfortunately, that's how we're built. And unfortunately, by the virtue of today's society, when our carbs are way too plentiful for us, but in terms of sort of ancestral and evolutionarily, carbohydrates are a very easy form of calories and they get converted into energy really quickly, so we actually want to be able to enjoy carbohydrates and find carbohydrates. But the comfort food component is also that it's connected to feeling soothed and warm and safe and sound and so on. And so when we're feeling a little bit more stressed out, which can happen as the day progresses for various reasons, we
right.
may also want those foods because they actually make us feel better, because they're connected to those feelings of being more relaxed and happier.
Right,
and
right.
Sometimes also being tired.
So how does one sort of counteract that without necessarily feeling stressed, but just to try to avoid giving into that craving?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I know that one of the things on the website was sort of how does grapefruit aroma help us with our cravings? And without going into that specifically, you know, one of the things that's interesting about our food cravings is that, you know, we're thinking about the food, we want that food, so we're kind of focused in on, you know, I really want to have a bagel or I really want to have a Danish right now. And one way, if you're not actually really hungry, of doing that is by distracting yourself and getting yourself into another frame of mind. And you can use different kinds of scents that, for instance, are special and evocative for you. So it doesn't, I'm not going to name any in particular, but if you have a fragrance that you find, you know, makes you feel really good, makes you feel happy, and you're actually not physically hungry, because if you are, you might want to eat something, but maybe just think about, you know, having fruit instead or whatever else, if, you know, or have that piece of cake, because I think it's also okay to have that, just not too much too often.
Right, right.
But you could use a fragrance that you find really captivating, and it can distract you and maybe take you down a trip down memory lane where you're in a totally different place mentally, and you're like, okay, I can carry on. You know, I don't need to eat that Danish right now.
Oh, interesting.
Joy, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you very much for answering my question, Rachel.
You're welcome.
So, Rachel, you said you don't want to mention any foods, but I want to mention them because I want to know about grapefruit, for instance, grapefruit aroma, and how it can potentially suppress appetite, or even olive oil.
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, what I meant is I didn't want to start, like, sort of giving prescriptions of, you know, smell this or smell that. But there have been some very interesting studies with specific odors. And the grapefruit odor, actually, so far, the data is only in rats, where what was shown in one particular study was that rats that were sniffing grapefruit aroma, their physiology, the metabolism, actually sped up amongst those rats compared to rats who weren't exposed to that odor. So that's something that hasn't been shown in humans, but extrapolating somewhat to humans, because in humans it has been shown that, for instance, orange odor helps sort of makes them eat less sort of snack food, especially chocolate. And in this particular study that was conducted anyway. And in that case, and also grapefruit aroma in the same way, it may be along the lines of memories being evoked by scent and so forth, that smelling healthy odors, like healthy fruits, might make someone be reminded that they have, you know, certain health intentions when it comes to food, and that actually maybe I shouldn't have that chocolate, I should have a piece of fruit instead. Another way, like for instance, olive oil can work, and also even the scent of vanilla, is that when you smell, for instance, vanilla, it actually makes the whatever you're eating taste sweeter. So that is to say that our taste cortex can also be activated by smells, which we're not, in fact, tasting at all, but our brain is responding to the smell. And conjoined with whatever we're eating, it can make that feel that it's make us feel that it's sweeter, and therefore we may be satiated with a little less. Likewise, olive oil aroma is something that's, you know, rich, and it's connected to when we normally have it. Oils are very high in calorie, and they're very satiating themselves. Mm-hmm. And so when something has olive oil in it, it can also produce those kinds of feelings that this is richer, more decadent, and I need less of it to feel full. And in the further end of it, what I was sort of explaining to Joy is that you can have aromas which totally distract you. So non-food aromas in general, but also ones that are particularly meaningful for you can be extra helpful.
I see. Got it. Well, I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and I'm speaking with Rachel Hertz, a neuroscientist who specializes in perception and emotion. She's the author of Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC, and I am back with neuroscientist Rachel Hertz for our latest Please Explain. So, Rachel, let's talk about what super tasters are. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. So super tasters are something that you are because of what you're born with, and it has to do with genetics. And so people are broken down depending on what sort of genetics they have on chromosome 7 in a particular location. And there's three different variations. One is being a super taster, another is being a taster, and the other final is being a non-taster. And so it just depends on the genetics that you were born with. And in sort of most Western societies, it breaks down in generally into thirds. Although there tend to be more women super tasters than men in the population. And also interestingly, but maybe not surprisingly, there are more chefs who are super tasters from a professional perspective than non-tasters or tasters. So what this means, though, is that you actually, if you're a super taster, have more taste buds on your tongue than if you're a taster or a non-taster. And that means that everything that you taste is more intense to you. So, and in particular, bitter is extremely unpleasant for super tasters. And so everything is more intense, and that also includes, like, if you're eating a hot pepper, that would burn more, and if you're having something really creamy, that would feel more creamy. But the tastes themselves are also more intense, and especially bitter can be quite bad. So most super tasters don't like grapefruit, they don't like black coffee, they don't like IPA beers, and so on.
Right. That's interesting. So if you are a super taster, that means you cannot tolerate black coffee, IPA beers, and endive. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, you could obviously force it down if you had to, but it's particularly unpleasant because bitter is an innately unpleasant taste, and that's because in nature, most poisons are bitter, so it's a good thing to avoid them, and so that's why we're built to dislike bitter. And if you're a super taster, you're particularly sensitive to all kinds of bitter, including the bitter that is in healthy leafy greens. So one of the perils of being a super taster is that super tasters aren't eating their healthy leafy greens as much, and they run the risk of potentially higher rates of certain kinds of cancers as a function of that.
Huh, and I guess there's a lot of nuance and variation there, because I know I could not stand IPA for a long time, and my girlfriend sort of convinced me that I needed to like it, and now I actually like it.
Well, that's one of the amazing things about food, is it's so emotional and so social that, for instance, I mean, that's a really good example, but also even taking something else like hot pepper eating. So when you eat a really hot pepper, it burns, and burning is not a pleasant sensation, at least not to most people. But because of the fact that it's in the context of food, it's in the context of fun, most people, even super tasters, can stand, you know, a certain amount of that. And interestingly, if you were to take the amount of capsaicin, when capsaicin is the chemical in hot peppers that makes the burn, and just give it to people in basically in like a water solution, solution, so out of the context of food, and someone who is a profoundly devoted, you know, habanero eater, or whatever, you know, that kind of person who loves hot peppers, and you give them the amount of capsaicin they would normally have and love, just in solution, they can't stand it. So it's because of food and all the emotional and social aspects that go with food that makes certain things that are unpleasant pleasant.
Interesting. Okay, so let's take another caller. Let's go to Carolyn in Sussex County, New Jersey, who has a question about sour flavors versus sweet.
Hi, Rachel. How are you?
Thank you, Carolyn. This is fascinating to me.
When I was, I've always liked sour over sweet. When I was pregnant, I drank a quart of grapefruit juice a day. I ate sweet tarts and all of that kind of stuff. And even to this day, you know, I'd much rather have spicy or sour than dessert. And I've just always wondered why that was. Sugar, I go through a pound of sugar every 2 years.
Well, so that's really interesting. So there is a fair bit of individual variation genetically from the point of view of both liking, so just your hedonic response to certain tastes, and the degree to which maybe certain taste buds are expressed in your tongue. So that even though what I was saying is sort of, I'm talking in generalities, people do differ. And so you may be someone who, from a genetic perspective, is more predisposed positively towards sour than, let's say, the average person in the population is. And maybe also sweet is sort of too sweet for you, so you don't find that
sweet.
As pleasant, because we all kind of like the middle ground, sort of the Goldilocks version of things. So if something is too intense, it's unpleasant, even if it's, so to speak, a pleasant sensation, like sweetness.
Mm-hmm. And what about addiction to cheese?
Well, I'm addicted to cheese as well. So one of the things, though, I mean, so cheese is, you know, wonderfully fatty, and fatty is a sensation that we are also born to love. And again, because I mentioned that it has, you know, packs such high calories, ounce per ounce, and we, technically speaking, need that. The other thing about cheese is that, as with most foods that we become quote-unquote addicted to, I don't really believe in addiction towards food, but the more we eat something, actually, the more we crave it. So interestingly, if you were to, for whatever reason, not, you know, really horribly deprive yourself, but just say, you know, I'm not going to keep cheese in the house for a month, you would be shocked, not that you wouldn't find cheese delicious if you had it, but that your desire for cheese would actually drop. And if you were to replace that with something else and start eating that other thing all the time, you'd actually want that other thing more.
All right, so Carolyn, go give it a try, and thank you so much for calling. So Rachel, can we talk about umami for a second? You talked about, you know, the lusciousness of the fatty flavor in cheese. Explain what umami is.
So umami is a Japanese word, and it literally means deliciousness. And it is a kind of a controversial sensation. So certain scientists and other people consider it to be a basic taste. In my book, I take a very strict criteria approach to what I'm including into the basic taste, and I only say that the four of salt, sour, sweet, and bitter are, you know, meeting all that criteria. Umami is something that is found in, for instance, from the point of view of if you ever had Chinese food and you know about monosodium glutamate, that is basically umami. It gives the sort of depth to foods. It gives a kind of dimensionality. It is definitely also savory. And one of the problems with it as a basic taste is that people often confuse it with saltiness. So, you know, you wouldn't confuse salty and sour or salty and sweet or bitter, but people can confuse umami with saltiness. But it is something that, for instance, is found also naturally in tomatoes, in bread, it's in mushrooms, and so on. And so it's in a lot of foods that we like, and when it's added to food, we tend to like that food more. It kind of gives depth to that food in and of itself.
But so many people try to avoid MSG. So is MSG bad for us?
So no, that is actually the whole Chinese restaurant syndrome thing is effectively a myth. And again, in one of these things that was kind of propagated and took off, and unfortunately the reality has lagged very far behind in people's mindset about it. The thing, though, that about Chinese food and monosodium glutamate is, as you can tell from the name monosodium glutamate, is that sodium is also present. And when we have a lot of salt, so eating too much salt, even though we may not sort of realize that we're having so much salt, can make us feel not so great sometimes. So sometimes the reaction has to do with too much salt. But umami in and of itself and MSG sort of just by itself is not the culprit.
I see. Okay. So I'm speaking with Rachel Hertz, a neuroscientist specializing in perception and emotion. She's the author of Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. And I see somebody on the line, John from Morristown. He wants to know how he tests if he's a super taster. Is John still there?
I am.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Yeah, you know, my question has actually evolved as I've been listening to you. So essentially, I taste things very strongly, and I smell things very strongly as well. And my wife does not. So we're constantly having a disagreement about how much of flavoring ingredients to put in food.
Hmm.
So I was wondering if there is a way to find out if we're in fact a super taster versus non-taster, or if it's something else.
Well, I don't know if you ever remember in high school chemistry that maybe a teacher brought in some PTC paper and got you to put it on your tongue. Or if not, then you can always go get some pretty easily. And this is a little compound that you can taste to find out if you can taste it and you find it extremely bitter, then you're a super taster. If your wife puts it in her mouth and can't taste anything, she's a non-taster.
Rachel, but repeat what it was again. I didn't hear
it. It's called PTC paper.
Okay.
It's a chemical that is, you know, very readily available. Like you can, it's just a piece of paper that's impregnated with it, and you can find it, if you could find it online, really easily. It's not in, you know, I don't really know where chemistry stores are these days, but you can definitely find it very easily online. And it's often used in high school chemistry classes or even biology classes to illustrate this sort of super taster, non-taster dimension. Another thing is just basically asking yourself, you know, are you someone that likes IPA beers, black coffee, endive, you know, bitter foods in general, and compare to your wife? So those are kinds of questions you can just kind of ask yourself or just test them out right now and sort of see how you guys react to it. With respect to the scent component, you know, everybody actually has a unique nose unless you have an identical twin. And what that means is that the specific receptors that are expressed in your nose for detecting all the volatile chemicals out there is ever so slightly different between every single person. And so certain people have, let's say, for example, also more copies of certain kinds of receptors than other people. And maybe you, John, have more copies of certain types of receptors that are relevant for food aromas than your wife does. And that may also be part of your experience in terms of flavor discussions.
That's interesting. You know, in terms of intensity, other than salt, any other flavor that I taste very strongly is unpleasant. And salt, I almost have a tolerance that it doesn't exist. I can have as much salt as somebody will put in food, and it almost never tastes bad to me. But for garlic, for example, if I taste it as an independent flavor as opposed to just something that's in the food, it really is unpleasant for me, and I smell it very strongly. I can smell it from, you know, blocks away. If somebody's cooking tomato sauce, for example, if they're making the garlic, I can smell it from extremely far away, and my wife will not smell anything, and she'll say, "You're crazy. There's nothing there."
Huh.
Well,
so
that's but that's an exact example of when something is stronger over a certain amount of toleration, it then becomes unpleasant. So you're extremely sensitive to the chemical compounds that make up garlic aroma, and therefore, unless it's super minimal, you're going to find it unpleasant. But someone else who's a lot less sensitive, who let's say has fewer receptors that are able to detect that compound, they can find a dose that you would say, oh my God, that's way over the top, totally fine.
So
I think that's where we are. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for answering my question.
Thanks for calling, John. And so, Rachel, is it possible that John can alter his taste buds?
Well, not really. So we are actually, and these are things that are, you know, hardwired, born with, you know, you can't sort of start messing with your own genetics, at least not now, at this point in time in our scientific endeavors. But we can change our attitudes to a certain extent. One of the problems, though, with flavor, because it's so much connected to aroma, and also because the tastes are hardwired generally in terms of liking and disliking, it's pretty difficult to make big leaps there. And with respect to aromas, when we've learned or in our experience something smells bad to us, it's really hard to learn then that actually that smells good. But one of the things you can do is, if you're aware of that, is to moderate, for instance, how much you would use. So if John didn't have to worry about his pleasing his wife's level of desire for garlic or other kinds of spices, let's just say he could use very little of it, but maybe just enough to give whatever he's cooking a certain degree of extra flavor oomph. And likewise, different amounts of salt or other kinds of basic tastes in the food that he's making. But we're born with, you know, the genetics of either detecting or not detecting, and the degree to which we can detect certain aromas, as well as having potentially more receptors attuned to particular tastes, and that can't be physiologically changed yet.
Okay, well, I think there's a caller on the line. His name is Joe. He's from Bayside. He had, I think, a very similar question, but let's see if he has anything to add. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What would you like to ask Rachel?
Well, I want to know if, as we get older, do our taste buds deteriorate or our sense of smell deteriorate? I'm in my 60s. I love to cook. In fact, I'm cooking right now. But pretty sure that there are things that I never tolerated when I was younger. Bitter, for example, bitter greens that I eat now and I love. I know for sure I don't smell like honeysuckle, for example, the way I used to. So, and I know for sure my wife's sense of smell is much more acute than mine. So, does something happen as we age?
Unfortunately, yes. Something happens.
Yeah, okay.
Just like with all our other senses, so our hearing and vision and so on, we tend to lose sensitivity as we age. Actually, it's less with taste than with smell. Definitely with smell, as we age, it gets worse, although there's a lot of individual variation. And unfortunately, your point about your wife is also true. Unfortunately for you, that is to say that women's sense of smell, their sensitivity is generally higher than men's throughout the lifespan, although they can be decreasing too. Men tend to decrease further and more. With respect to taste, the same thing happens. Actually, interestingly, what you said about bitter greens, bitter taste decreases less in terms of sensitivity than our other tastes do, but it also decreases as well. And because there's a lot of individual variation, you could be someone who's been more affected in the bitter domain. So yes, is the answer to your question.
Okay. Is that also, you know, I know there's a big boom in whiskey. And I know a lot of young people do, but I've noticed over the years, people my age in the 60s, we're drinking more and more whiskeys than we ever did when we were younger. And I was wondering if it's also, you can tolerate a certain strength in whiskey that we couldn't when we were younger.
Yes, that is also true. One, because that sort of burn sensation, that also decreases with age, but also our experience and our kind of mindset about why we are drinking whiskey, or sort of the meaning of whiskey to us, or, you know, what your the sort of all the ideas you have about whiskey are also probably changing from
Rachel,
when you were 20.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much. It's been really interesting. I've been speaking with neuroscientist Rachel Hertz. She's the author of You Are What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. I'm sorry, Why You Eat What You Eat, The Science Behind Our Relationship with Food. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It was great to be on, Cindy.